everybody, to Talking Bark, Bark Academy Australia's podcast, hosted by me, Madeline Easton. I'm the artistic director. This is the first podcast we've actually filmed, that we've sort of done live. So it's really exciting. Hopefully we can continue this on through our other 11 podcasts throughout the year. But I'm delighted to have as my guests today, Benjamin Skepa, the world famous cellist and composer and experimental electronic artist, and Olivia Ansell, the artistic director of this year's Sydney Festival. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us, Maddie.
No worries. Okay, so here we go. Would you like to talk a little bit about how you got Ben involved and your vision for this week of Bach?
Absolutely. So I'll start from the beginning.
Okay, no, that's great.
I was flying to Europe earlier in 2023, as you do, one festival finishes, and apart from sort of scouring the country and all of Sydney, you also spend a lot of time scouring the globe looking for really interesting stories. And anyway, I was catching this plane. I think I was just going to London first and then sort of traveling from there. So I had a very long flight and thought I would watch Tar, starring Kate Blanchett. And it was that opening scene, one of the opening scenes, and she's teaching the young student from Juilliard, who says, I'm not going to play the music of Bach.
I remember it.
Why? Because he's cancelled. And I remember sort of reflecting on that. I'm actually a lecturer at the Conservatory of Music, and I sort of, you know, a lot of empathy for the situation of her lecturing this student in that moment. And it's like, can you cancel Bach? I mean, you know, I just sort of thought about it. And as I sat there watching the film and, you know, sort of traveling a lot during that period and listening to so many different musical canons and albums by so many different artists, in my experience when listening to Bach, he was such a musical genius, the god of harmony, as they say. But I feel as though his music has informed so many songwriters and composers' technique and style. It'd be like saying, I want to be a mathematician, but I'm going to cancel math class. You know, like it was. And so I sort of went down this kind of inspiring journey of, what if we put this program together where we celebrated and we deconstructed Bach, and we looked at all of the different musical influences and worked with a broad canon of artists, Australian artists, that and some international, that could really celebrate and deconstruct everything that Bach stood for in his music. And it was a mutual colleague of Benjamin's and mine that said, oh, you should meet each other. And so we began this dialogue. I said to Benjamin, oh, I've got this idea to do a program of music by Bach, but see where it takes us, you know, like the, it can be composers with music. He was influenced by Bach, and we engaged different companies to say, look, here's the brief, do what you want, you know, let's go. And so I met Benjamin, and his background and his extraordinary electroacoustic compositions and everything that's inspired Benjamin in his career. And as I say, you play all of Bach's toys, you know, harpsichord, piano, cello. And we just kind of embarked on this relationship that really clicked. And next thing you know, we were engaging artists, including your good self, Maddie, and Bark Academy, and many other acts, Ensemble Apex, and you know, like Korkmaz, incredible Turkish concert pianist, and the Brandenburg, of course, and the program sort of grew from there.
That's amazing. That's really, really great. And how do you feel, Ben, about being asked to co-curate it with Olivia?
Yeah, I think to echo what Olivia's saying as well, when we kind of consider the broad canon of music as a whole, and we're speaking very much in Western musical and classical music terms, and I think classical music is quite widely misunderstood, because the Baroque era is actually not classical music, it's actually Baroque.
That's right.
And as we were discussing before, we were talking about, as I also work at the Conservatorium in Moscow, And you were speaking about how some of the Russians are like, why would you be playing this early strange music, you know, and this kind of, I suppose, this kind of dilution of the different epochs of music that have defined now modern and pop music, for example. And so as we discussed, and I'm really thankful that Olivia did bring on board this project, because I think it allows us to really go into the depth of music theory and, as we said, the god of harmony with these concepts of contrapuntal, which is also, say, for example, in my studio, but allowing audiences to maybe lean into not just the music itself, but actually the history and the interpretation and, if you want to, some of the academic kind of underpinnings of what music is really about, if you wish to. And so the name temperament that we came up with was really a reference not only to the human condition and also as we live in these really kind of troubled times right now, like reflecting on, you know, your life and coming out to the Sydney Festival in summer and like it being a joyful moment against this backdrop of really crazy world events, you know, that we can also still celebrate and come together and have fun. So kind of considering our temperament within that, also the concept of musical temperament that Bach also coined and really mastered in terms of equal temperament, which now kind of underpins our systems and the tuning of orchestras and our ringtones and all these kinds of things. So there's a lot underneath all of the programming and the curation that we discussed prior to kind of letting this out of the bag. But within that, there's lots of space for the audiences to come and discover, especially with your music as well and your offering, which will really be canvassing a very purest form of what Bach is. And I really love the program that you've come up with as well in terms of, you know, really going deep into the early works of Bach all the way through to the later in life of this flamboyant and fabulous avant-garde composer.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you say about the ringtones, because there's a familiarity, there's a formula to Bach's music that makes it addictive. And it was interesting coming to your concert at Government House, and which I just so enjoyed. That was February. And I went home and I was on this sort of journey by then, you know, in any case. And I woke up in the middle of the night hearing one of the pieces in my head that the Bach Academy had performed. And I couldn't get it out of my head, but I couldn't name the piece. And because I did study the violin as a young person, but my leading art form was dance, classical ballet. And then I went into other, you know, like theatre and music theatre and what have you. But ballet and modern dance were kind of the leading art form for me, which of course, classical music, including so much Bach, is what you performed to and you studied. But anyway, this piece of music was going around in it like an earworm in my head. So then I got up in the middle of the night on Spotify and just like, which cantata, which motet, what was it? And I started trying to find it. And in doing so, I found the Swingle Sisters.
Oh, the Swingle Singers.
Who I love. The Swingle Singers, sorry, not the Swingle Sisters. The Swingle Singers, whom I love but I'd forgotten about. And then I went down their whole take on Bach, which is fabulous. But it's like, wow, it's so clever. It's sometimes his compositions were so simple, but so clever. And you can hear so many other inspirations from his music in more contemporary writers.
Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga. In the beginning of Poison Romance. The beginning of that is one of the preludes and fugues. It's C-sharp minor, I think. She went to Juilliard or something.
Of course.
You know, Lady Gaga is being inspired by Bach, I think Bach is doing okay in modern times.
Indeed.
Absolutely. And I think, like, in that regard too, like, I work a lot in electronic music scenes as well and with DJs and producers. And similarly as well, people are constantly referencing but actually not even knowing who they're even ripping, I think, sometimes, which I think is also interesting. So, you know, us all being quite classically trained as well, so trained in ballet like Olivia too, and you're kind of exposed constantly to these styles and epochs of music, but not understanding, I guess, the broader framework within which they all exist now as we live in these really free times of creative and musical expression. It's so exciting.
Well, you know, if I may say so, I think you guys have done something super smart here. I really do, because you've picked the one composer that, I mean, it's 24 karat gold music. You can't destroy it.
You can't.
No matter how much you mess with it, deconstruct it, tear it up, layer it, put it through filters, God knows what, it's still 24 karat gold music. Do you know what I mean? Not to say that's what we were doing, obviously. But, you know, for me, he's the alpha and the omega. You know, he's the beginning and the end. You know, he brought together everything that had come before, everything he'd learned from the Renaissance and, you know, from Buxtehude, from Schütz, from Gabriele Monteverdi. He brought it all together. And look what he did to it. It's still so relevant and modern.
But don't you think that his music's really clever in that it wrote back to the Renaissance era, but it also wrote forward out of the Baroque era. Like, you could hear his influences in his later music. It's like, oh, wow, how did you know that that was the trend or that was the style that was coming? And he also had an incredible ear for casting back. And, like, you know, he lived till his 60s. And in that entire time, like, not many composers in one short life can cast their taste and can write with skills to go so far back in time and so far forward.
I know. The other clever thing about Bach, I feel, is he's probably the only composer that stimulates your intellect just as much as your emotions. And if you want to, like you said before, Ben, if you really want to get nerdy, you can. Because you can get right into the mathematics, the symbology, the cryptology, the numerology, and look at all the relationships that are there and the clever little references and numerological relationships, Golden Meads, Fibonacci really series, everything. It's all there, you know.
And I think that's the essence of when we talk about harmony as well. Bach's music is spiralic. And when you think about a spiral as a sacred form that moves into infinity, you know, that's actually quite mind-blowing when you allow yourself to move out of the mathematics into the esotericism as well. And I think Baroque music particularly was very much, obviously, very embedded in the church as well, and the benefactors of the composers as well, who allowed them the space and the time and the resources to really then dig down into the annals of their spirits and transduce this music onto paper, which, if you think that's 300 years ago, what a feat. We've got so much technology and so many kind of apparatus now that allow us to cheat, I could almost say.
But that's really interesting. Yeah, like, that's interesting, because the music, the mathematics required to create the music 300 years ago, as you said, Benjamin, like, informs the science that was discovered. You know, like, I'm sitting here thinking Bach would have been the stimulus for Einstein to work out, you know, the different theorems of relativity, like, to work out the different formulas required, and then other scientists that are inspired by Einstein's theories, and so on and so forth. Like, there's long been thought that the computer was invented by a bunch of computer scientists who were inspired by Salvador Dali's paintings, because of the theories of relativity that he followed by being inspired from Einstein's. So if you keep tracing that back, then absolutely the great composers like Bach would have informed science as it progressed too. They're interrelated. I mean, if you're a great composer, you may as well be an astrophysicist, you know.
It's so interesting you say that, Liv, and I think in that time too, like, arts and the sciences are very much together still, and in my practice, and again with the performance that I'm presenting as well, which is more on the avant-garde end, let's say, of the inspirations of Bach, like, that art-science crossover was actually quite natural in that era. And as you said, there was all this cross-pollination of ideas and what we'd call that kind of multidisciplinary art practice, and there's lots of other ways you can say that. But back then, it was really just a natural corollary of being in a scene with amazing minds and thinkers and doers, and the way that we'd kind of influence each other's practices and then come out with these new discoveries. And I think that's what's brilliant about your kind of concept of bringing this Bach Week together. It's really touching upon the necessity of us now with all of this capacity to connect globally. And again, with you and the Bach Academy, Madeline, like, bringing your expertise from so many years away in Europe and all that study and all the people that you've met and all the amazing musicians who are dedicating their lives as well to this particular composer. I mean, I could never do that personally, but I really respect that there's there are people like yourself and these musicians who are dedicating their practice to honing and refining and perfecting, as you will present for us, like, this masterful rendition of these sacred compositions. I think that's absolutely important, as so much seems to be getting lost in this information superhighway. And
I know,
you know, there's
just
so much. So I think it's really important work what you're doing, is what I'd like to say.
Well, actually, it's not about... Oh, sometimes you can delve into the super nerdy side of it, but even if you know everything about the Bach, and even if you know nothing about the Bach, you can come to a concert and just close your eyes and be taken to somewhere different, and you will feel better.
Oh, indeed.
I mean, don't get me started on the health benefits of it. But, you know, I think when I discovered the cantatas of Bach, that's when I really got Bach as a person, and you know, as instrumentalist, Ben, you're probably the same. You've been playing Bach your whole life, right? I want to ask you about your journey with Bach, and I'd love to ask you about your journey with Bach as a composer as well. But mine started with Suzuki minuets, you know, da 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 da.
Suzuki, yes.
And I thought, oh, that's all right. That's quite pleasant. You know, and then I got a bit better and I started playing some of the, you know, the concertos and then the solo sonatas and partitas. And then when I hit London and joined the English Baroque Soloists, Monteverdi Choir, then I discovered the cantatas and I thought, oh my God. And then fast forward 19 years and I thought, well, no one's doing this seriously in Australia. Where are the cantatas here? Who's elevating this music to the concert stage like they do in Europe, you know? The answer was, well...
Yeah. Good on you, and thank goodness
for
the Bach Academy.
That's the whole reason I'm doing this, is to just put this music out there, front and centre in the public eye, and give it the platform that it is given everywhere else, you know.
Yeah, I think that's really important to saying it's about this kind of preservation concept. But I'm similarly with you. I started with piano, so that's I'd also played the minuets on piano. And I mean, Suzuki method was interesting too, wasn't it? Because it wasn't about the reading of the music. That Japanese method is really about listening on the cassette tapes, you know, and then like recalling and then putting that through your fingers or your arms, however, whatever instrument you were playing. And they were kind of reconsidered or remixed for all the different instruments. But I started with Suzuki as well and then moved through again with ballet, as Olivia was saying, and then harpsichord. And harpsichord was interesting because if you go back to Temperament and the Well-Tempered Clavier, which was Bach's seminal composition for every black and white note of the keyboard, and keyboard referring at that time to harpsichord and organ, for example, because the piano wasn't invented until after that. And I just had to say that I think a lot of people don't know that little bit
That's
of information.
Actually,
the piano
I know
came later.
I know the exact date that Bach actually met a piano for the first time.
Oh, what date?
I think it was the 4th of May, 1747, when he went to visit
his son. Very close to the end, really, wasn't it?
Just 3 years before he died.
Wow.
And he went to visit his son, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, in the Palace of Sanssouci, where King Frederick the Great of Prussia was, and that's where he got challenged with the musical offering theme. And then he was taken around and he had 20 Silbermann newfangled forte pianos to show off to the old Bach.
Oh,
I know.
Only 20.
Only 20. So there we go.
Well, that was the thing, because the piano is very different to like the harp or the harpsichord, because you can't auto-tune it so easily. So when I was given this harpsichord to start playing, it's to play in an unconducted chamber ensemble. We were all between the ages of like 5 and 9 years old, young, basically prodigy kids, all playing concertos at ridiculously young ages. And I was given this harpsichord, and I'd never played one before because I played piano. They're like, you'll be able to work it out. And it came to tuning, and I was fortunately born with perfect pitch. So like when I went to tune it, it was pretty, so you know as well, but it also can be kind of a plague in your mind as well. But when I went to tuning, no one taught me how to do it, but then I came in naturally to my ears to the cycle of fifths. And so I'd tune in the cycle of fifths, not knowing what it even was. And then I'd get to the end of the cycle, and then you move to the end of the cycle, and then the whole thing's out of tune. And I'm like, hang on a minute, what's going on with that? And that's how I understood this kind of Pythagorean comma concept, but again, didn't know what it was. And then right before the concert, I'd like retune like chromatically back down the scale and try and get it sounding right and play a few triads and chords. And, you know, I was seven for goodness sake, how ridiculous. And it took me really until I really went to Russia, honestly. But prior to that, I'd become quite interested. And as you touched upon before, like even if you don't know any of the artists or any of the music that's coming in the Temperament program, just come and listen to it because it will heal you. That's unequivocal.
Yeah.
But I started to like, when I left classical training, I picked up the cello, I think I was 10, and then I went through the Bach suites, which every cellist is forced to play even if you don't want to, and they're really bloody hard, even though they sound not so difficult, they're so hard to play. And after I kind of had realized that the classical path wasn't my own like kind of path in this life, I'd done nearly 2 decades of the classical training, I thought, right, what am I going to do? And I started really looking at kind of sacred geometry and music and art therapy and how that might scientifically more come to bear in terms of you know, explaining why we have certain reactions to certain types of music. And going back to this Pythagorean comma concept, when I met these Russian researchers from the Academy of Sciences and Moscow Conservatorium, and you were talking about Fibonacci before, they'd come out with this new discovery around music and genetics, and based on our human DNA, which eschews the Fibonacci sequence in mathematics. And I was like, wow, that blew my kind of mind when I heard that. And when they asked me, you know, what I thought about it, well, the first question I asked to them was, how have you dealt with this Pythagorean comma, this tuning anomaly we have in the classical music system? And they're like, Benjamin, you're hired. I'm like, okay. And these very kind of small shifts that have occurred in temperament, in tuning over the centuries, are still going on now, and things are still being discovered. And I think this wonderment that we have around music and sound generally, and its capacity to really impact upon the human condition, is really what my practice has now become about, and why I think it's important for people such as yourselves to really be preserving the tradition of masters such as Bach, but also for us to be also pushing the boundaries on experimentation and with the technology to then present further future offerings that, you know, then inspire the next generations again and along, especially in the classical world, because our program isn't just about Baroque or classical music either. There's a very diverse, I don't really like that word, but, you know, a diverse kind of offering of artists that are coming along who are not playing Bach at all, you know, as well, but are influenced by, or they're influenced within the music as well. So it's not literal in that sense. And that's what I think makes it really exciting. Mm-hmm. But I'm thankful for my Bach training, for sure. It's definitely, you know, informs, you know, technique and harmony, I think, is a really big one. And then you unpick it a little bit and you think, how do I shift that and surprise people maybe a little bit, push their buttons in different kinds of ways. But I'd like to ask you a question just quickly on that. You know, when you are interpreting the music, and us being classically kind of indoctrinated by that too, because it's brutal, let's say that, but if you get your interpretation wrong, you know, you get kind of a slap on the wrist. But, you know, we didn't live in the Baroque era, unless you go into your past life journeys, for example. But, you know, in terms of the way that you seek to interpret your music in that way, do you feel like that your European experience has really helped with the interpretations by being immersed in the cultures within which Bach operated, and obviously the institutions there that are dedicated to that music? Or how do you come to approaching, like, the way that you feel and perform Bach yourself and with all your musicians?
I think, well, number one, the instruments inform you far more than being in a country does. You know, you're dealing with an instrument that, well, in the case of the violin, doesn't have a shoulder rest or chin rest. It sits on your collarbone. Mm. It's got a shorter fingerboard, different bridge, different tailpiece, gut strings, and that bow. I can never remember if that's convex or concave.
Convex.
Okay.
Concave.
Anyway, that way. Yeah. Looks like a bow and arrow. Mm. It's that way.
Yes.
And the Baroque bows, they're amazing, aren't they?
And so when you have those instruments, you can't play them the same way as you can on a modern instrument. You're forced to play them differently. And what I've found is I now have such a much greater appreciation of how far Bach actually pushed the boat out. Because if you try and play, for example, those devilishly difficult fugues on a Baroque violin without the support.
Oh, yes.
Then you know just how damn hard they were at the time and just how groundbreaking they were. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So you have the instruments themselves and you have that beautiful bow which shapes the notes for you. You don't even have to try to shape them. And I find on a modern bow, you fight the heavy tip all the time. And you on a Baroque bow, the up bows are automatically lighter than the down bows. And you automatically get the hierarchy. You know,
because the technique is responsible for the different sound.
Yeah.
It's the technique of playing a Baroque instrument that brings that. You know, it's interesting because my background started both with ballet and with music. I had a professional, I had a mother who was a professional dancer and a father who was a professional musician. And he was a pianist and he did all of his classical music training but became a jazz composer and a jazz pianist. Yeah. That was his love, but obviously well-trained in his classical rudiments to be able to be that.
Yeah.
I also studied the Suzuki method on violin, and I would come up against the child prodigies of you two and think this is no match for me. But it was also it was also like, when did those colored dots stop? You know, it was like, how many years of the colors that you were so good at learning the colors? I used to think one day, when will the colors stop and when will I start actually learning about the notes? But I did love the Suzuki method, and actually I have a little 2.5-year-old son who gets all sorts of musical instruments as toys, and they give you the sheet music, and it is a rip-off of the Suzuki method with all the colors. Aww. So it brings it back. Good. But yeah, it's quite funny. But
I didn't get the colors.
You missed out. Well, in the end, my father, because my grandmother, his mother was a violinist, and he said, you have to choose, because this is too important a job. This is too important a study. You either focus on the violin or you focus on the ballet. And so I chose the ballet. And interestingly, we're talking about the technique of a Baroque instrument. There are different techniques in ballets. So there's Vaganova technique. There's the Royal Academy of Dance. That's a different technique. There's Cicchetti. And Allegro, which is the jumping in ballet with Vaganova, the entire structure of the technique is to get you in the air. So it's a short plié, and as you said, you plié, and it's like, and up and up and up and up. So the rhythm and the way that your muscles work to that technique is to get you up and buoyant in the air. Other techniques I found through my training put the emphasis on the down, which I don't think they meant to, but it just sort of turned out that way, that young students learning the classical technique of ballet, when they are undertaking the Allegro section, it's about and down and down and down and down, because they're trying to get them to stretch their feet in the air before they land. But it's the lightness and the spring of Vaganova technique, of the up and the up and the up, that makes you a powerful dancer who can jump and spring. And, you know, it's really important, like your buoyancy and how you can alight from the floor, particularly in pas de deux and in more difficult repertoire as you become a professional dancer, if you don't have that technique embedded. But it actually comes down to tempo and timing and technique, and how the classical form is structured to the music engineers what kind of dancer you will be. And so when I heard that description of the different instruments from Baroque to contemporary instrumentation, it's a similar thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh my god, everything you're saying is amazing, because I studied classical ballet for years as well, actually, and I had to choose at some point. I chose the violin.
Oh,
and you chose dance. And you know what's really amazing?
And we've all ended up here in the same world.
I know,
in the
right?
festival.
What is going on here?
My goodness.
One can't live without the other, you know, certainly.
Oh, God, I was just in true so festival torn collaborations.
Yeah. You were torn about the decision.
I was so torn. I still adore ballet so much.
Oh, I know. Why were we made to choose? I know why I was.
I was not meant to be a ballet dancer.
I don't think I was meant to be a violinist. I think I could see the protégés in the room, and I just thought, although I was sort of holding on to my own, I could see at some of the recitals, you know, you'd go into the city and we'd each get up. And I have to say, some of the students, they might only have been about 5 or 6 years of age. Incredible.
Mm. But you came from such
reminding
an
amazing... Reminding me of my Stedford days.
So. Oh, yes. God, no. PTSD, stop right there, my friend.
But something you said about those 5, 6-year-olds, like, and again, going back to a little bit to, I work between the Rimsky-Korsakov and the Tchaikovsky conservatories. And one thing that's happening now, and obviously, like, I grew up with a lot of Asian kids around me too, and I'm a quarter Japanese, so I kind of say that with brevity. But, you know, the Asian kids were like little robots, like so bloody good and so young. And recently speaking with, you know, the directors of the conservatoriums, like they're not seeing the kids come through anymore. In the same way, which I think is interesting, because I mean, I'm in my 40s now, so like pegging it back like literally 40 years ago when I started, you know, that in these 4 decades, yes, I think there is a shift going on in terms of the commitment of, let's say, our parents to fostering that education for the children. Because I know for my mum and dad, mum particularly, was, I've got 2 sisters also trained in ballet and violin and viola and everything else, so they're just driving us around to get to the lessons first, and then also having the money to pay for them. You know, that was a serious in in the future of your child, let's say, and you know, as I said, look at us now, we've all landed here with these kind of stories that, that are quite similar, but we've all manifested that training quite differently. I remember when I ended up at university and I ended up at law school, believe it or not, and I quit the music. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I don't know what I'm going to do, but you know, I started doing my own kind of research and studies. But a lot of those prodigy kids that I'd grown up with all ended up in medicine, law and engineering. Mm. And I thought, isn't that interesting? They're like, if you play classical music to your kid while they're in the womb, they're going to be really clever. I mean, I don't know if that's true or not, but there seems to be something that stems from the classical music education that certainly ends up in, let's say, the DNA or the bones of these children, I think, who do go on to maybe take the training and, you know, you say the PTSD that comes with some of the parts of it, but then, you know, transform that into other areas of their lives. And that's something I've definitely noticed with a lot of the people that I've now reconnected with. Say third, we played in quartets when we were like nine or whatever. And you see someone 30 years later, you're like, oh, hi, I haven't seen you for a while. What are you up to? Kind of thing. And you reconnect. But there's definitely something I feel in terms of the environment that I grew up in as well, that that the training definitely helped us in life with. So it's interesting to say, living with your son, obviously now being exposed to all the gadgets and everything and having that kind of opportunity, you know, I think it's really important because you can't rely on schools anymore, I think, to do that. My nephews mm-hmm. now, like, they're all on GarageBand and, you know, iPads, and he's learning mm-hmm. how to code at like year four. And it's like, goodness me, couldn't have thought of anything worse than year four to be doing. I want to be outside running around with my friends, you know, but that's not what they do anymore. It's really become very digital. So when the conservatoriums in both Moscow and St. Petersburg were saying we're not really seeing the kids anymore, it kind of alarmed me a little bit. And again, it brings it back to what you're doing with the Bach Academy as well, about this concept of preservation. I feel like we are at risk of losing a lot. And although in our program, we're modernizing and, you know, reconstructing and deconstructing Bach, let's say, the true homage is to the past. We are still looking back into the brilliance of that, but looking to move forward by bringing that forward with us and
feel like keeping it with you. Yeah, keeping it.
Yeah, you know, it's really important. You can't just make these things up. Like you were just saying before about the Baroque bows, it reminded me. I was on this residency on the border of Austria and Croatia, and I met this amazing jazz violinist who played with a Baroque bow. And I've never played anything other like a viola da gamba, but I've never tried to play. So I've never had the experience of the curvature of the bow. But I mean, he was playing noise music on a Baroque bow. It was like kind of crazy. But very, you know, I guess he's considered the father of jazz in Portugal, like a really cool guy. But I kind of had a little feel of the bow and as you're saying about the technique before, like that is actually a thing, you know, to be it able is. To master that. It doesn't just happen in a year or even 10 years. It's a lifetime of dedication and practice and constancy to maintain that physically as well. Like your body, like you said, without the shoulder rest here, and you see those violins with the big bruises on the sides of their faces from playing so much. Like it's like musicians are actually athletes is like what else I like to say to some people too. Like what we do is very physical. Obviously dances are physical, but you know, like the body is your instrument as well. And the self-care that has to happen as a result of that too, which we aren't often taught, you know, how to look after yourself, you know?
It's the keeping, you touched on something there, Ben, that that really resonated. It's, we can experiment, you know, like the music of George Crumb and his sort of fascination with electroacoustic music. As a dancer myself, I discovered modern dance, you know, when I was a teenager and then really valiantly pursued that as a career, in fact.
And you were brilliant, I'm told.
Oh, I don't know. But, you know, I did.
You told me how good you really were. Yes.
I did love performing, and I did love studying all the various canons of modern dance. But it's amazing how the music comes back to you, because if you study the choreography or the compositions of Twyla Tharp or the technique of Cunningham or Taylor or Graham or Horton and the many postmodern techniques that existed before Release Technique and many, many others came on the scene, they were all working to the music of Meredith Monk and John Cage and Morton Feldman and George Crumb. And so that whole movement in the 70s, the 60s and 70s, and you know, some would say the 50s as well, of postmodernism,
mucking about with the compositions of Bach and what have you. And now organizations, we play that music, we celebrate that postmodernism, but we still go back to, you know, to 300 years ago, and we haven't forgotten Baroque music, we haven't forgotten the Renaissance period, we just see the postmodern period as another phase. And so I think, to that digitization question, should we be afraid of the future in terms of AI generated music, in terms of young people not picking up a violin in school now because there's all these digital instruments? I'm now thinking I should get my childhood violin down for Geordie and put dots on it really quickly and, you know, get him.
give him a few years.
But is this another phase? Are we in another phase, and in 50 years from now, we're still playing Renaissance era music and Baroque, and nothing's changed, we've just added more phases to the library? Or are we at a pivotal moment that we can't wind back from?
Yeah. Gosh. I feel pivotal, Olivia. I feel pivotal in that regard. I absolutely feel what you're saying. And I think in the age group that we're at as well, I think you kind of examine, if you go back to, I really go back to Béla Bartók, if we're really honest. You really want to start thinking about, when did music really start to push out and forward? And, you know, again, you kind of go then through the New York scene and maybe the 50s or the 80s, like you say, and it's kind of crummy and, you know, Cagey and all these, like the Fluxus and all these kind of amazing things that were going on. But I feel like a lot in the art and music history, that the conversations around, like, not only just Bach, but even Bartók, like, are totally absent. And I get quite upset about it. And, you know, that people appropriate others' information and don't reference it. And that's what I think is really interesting about our program as well, this is a really direct call to, hey, if you really want to delve deeply into the truth of things in a Western classical or musical concept, like, this is your chance to really, like, have a look, you know, because there's so many, like, history doesn't exist in a vacuum either. We're constantly building. And like you said, we're the AI-generated music. It's not just AI music. It's AI law now. Like, you go onto Facebook
and it's everything, like, isn't it? Yeah.
Write a contract on AI now. It's like, it's insane. And look, I'm all for technology. I love it. I'm excited by it. I think it's connective. I think it's exciting, you know, and it's changed everything forever. But I suppose because of our respective trainings, we have that body memory, you know, that physical memory of doing the work. And there's no way to replace that or to supplement it. You have to actually do it. Mm. And in the physicality of the doing is kind of that analog process. And then you kind of find yourself into this digital realm now where if you don't pick up the digital, you almost become defunct. Mm. That part annoys me a bit too. But I think it's finding, for me, it's about finding that balance. If we can find a good balance between them, and new curators like yourself and myself and musicians like yourself as well, Madeline, to be preserving and presenting and putting it in the audience's faces, you know, in their hands, and giving opportunity as well to chance upon it. Again, like when people think of Bach, they might think daggy or boring, you know, which is absolutely rude. But it's a lack of education, it's a lack of awareness. And as you said, when you established Bach Academy in Australia, you were really coming into very infertile ground. And I've also just moved back from being away for, you know, 15 odd years. And Australia is an interesting place in that regard, because we lack a tradition other than the tradition of what we've done to our First Nations people, really. And as a result of that, we also therefore have a freedom that, say, the English or the Russians or the Japanese or the Italians or the Germans don't have. And I think that creates amazing opportunity, which you obviously saw. And now Australia's leading ensemble presenting Bach's music. And although it's hard to drive new audiences who are unaware of things, by presenting it to them, you're educating them and then giving them a chance to then, you know, fall or lean into something and learn about something and fall in love with it, hopefully, as well. But I think what you've done is really brilliant in that regard.
Thank you. Thanks. Well, I just think all of us, we're still drawing on the inspiration of Bach, you know, 300 and whatever years later. You know, we're not done with it yet, are we?
No, absolutely not.
We're not done with any of whatever we choose to draw inspiration from, whether it's Bartók or Morton Feldman or, you know, contemporary dance or any of these art forms. We're not done. We're going to always be drawing on them. I know I will.
I can assure you that Paul Dyer isn't done. The Brandenburg Orchestra have quite a program for temperament. They have collaborated with Severi, this wonderful Paris opera trained dancer. So he was a professional dancer. He's an incredible visual artist. And they're performing a series of Bach pieces to this visual artist painting this mural on stage. And originally I thought it was just Paul on harpsichord with Silvère. But the cast seems to grow bigger every time I speak to Paul and Noel. I think there's like 20 people on stage. It's this incredible murals being painted. And then Ensemble Apex are performing Come Sweet Death, obviously a piece that Bach wrote close to sort of the time of his own, reflecting on his own mortality and when he did indeed pass. We're inviting audiences to lie on yoga mats by candlelight with sort of flickering candles and low-level lighting in the ACO Nielsen space. So, and that follows you, Benjamin, with Preludia and Wifey, amazing electroacoustic score. So we really do. And to kick off that morning, we've got Andrew Bekenya doing Bach in Colour, where he's inspired by composers who were inspired by Bach. So from Paul McCartney, Roberta Flack, Poulenc, you know, this incredible eclectic mix. And he too is inspired by the Swingle Singers. So he has 14 vocalists singing a cappella in the morning. So we go on this kind of journey right through the Saturday and Sunday that rounds out the whole week that Bach Academy starts. So I can definitely say that we're not done with Bach yet. Certainly not until the 28th of January when this program concludes.
God, I don't know how we're going to feel at the end of that, but it's going to be quite a week. It is. But what's
I love kind of the intersection as well at the end, Olivia, with Ensemble Apex as well, because you're going through that funeral. Was it the cantata?
Is
that
Actus Tragicus? Yes.
Yeah, Actus Tragicus. That's right. And then it kind of rounds all the way back to the end with Ensemble Apex also going through this. It's quite dark, and you know, you don't expect a string quartet of young, emerging and exceptional performers to be tackling philosophy and issues like that through the music, which I think is brilliant. And then, as Olivia said, you know, we're going into the ACO Nielsen space, which is absolutely gorgeous. I'd say it'd be rivaling the Opera House, or perhaps even with its technology there now, surpassed it in terms of what it offers as an electroacoustic space.
Yeah.
When I went to a little site visit and, you know, I went down and visited them, and they're so lovely and really technically aware, I thought, wow, how amazing that we have these concert halls that are now not churches as well. Churches, I think, can feel very, and cathedrals, we've all performed them, but can feel very alienating and colonial. And we've got this kind of new, you know, this Wharf precinct, the Festival that Olivia came with, this brilliant idea where we're going to be completely recasting, but also going back to, you know, everybody's going in there and booze on after work, you know, it was a place of congregation. And now that we're out of this, it is really clever, but it's about community and coming together. And this is what music does for us as well, you know. But, you know, being able to transform these classical spaces, even though the ACO is modern, by, as Olivia said, yoga mats and beanbags and low light flickering, as is this multi-sensory kind of sense as well, that it's about, you know, breaking down the barriers to access and inclusivity and feeling like everybody's welcome. And this is absolutely the point of it as well, from your purest roots all the way through to, we don't know where we're going to end up, honestly, tragic and death and dark and wow, you know, and rearranging everyone's molecules in some kind of way.
Yeah.
But I think that's the excitement of it, and the entire program, not just of Temperament and this Bach Fest, but the entire festival as a whole as well. It's so well thought out and well put together, and moving down into the walls where we're going to be performing in this really state-of-the-art, you know, concert hall. I'm so excited to see what we can sonically do to the walls in there as well, because I believe the buildings absorb the energy of all the performers and all the performances that go through there, and that's what makes the space so exciting. And I think the ACO are really excited for us to be coming in there and doing this in their space as well, because it's adventurous and it's experimental, and absolutely Australian audiences deserve that. And I'm really grateful that Olivia has the vision to present audiences here with that, because as you and I both spent so long overseas, that becomes pretty standard, you know, not to cross compare and that, but there's definitely a difference there. And so I think what's really exciting about this is that audiences now have a chance to take a risk, come with that expectation or perception or bias, and just be there and be in it. And then go and have a drink afterwards at the club next door. How amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
But you know what European audiences don't have? they don't have Olivia's amazing talent for immersive theatre. That's one of the things I did read about you, was your incredible sort of the way you've taken the immersive experience and really done things with it. No one else has. No one else anywhere in the world.
Oh, thanks, Maddie. I mean, yeah. I think the whole world is kind of moving and migrating to an appetite of experiential and immersive. You know, we see musicals, we see musical experiences, digital experience like projection mapping. We've all seen those type of big visual art spectacles. But it is a sign of the times, isn't it? Because in this year's brochure, we have a department in the brochure called immersive, and that traverses all the genres in the festival. And I think there's about 11 immersive experiences in this year's Sydney Festival. We have Night Songs at Coney Island, where you will board a little Rosman ferry from the Thirsty Mile and take a charter over to Coney Island and disembark at one of Sydney's most retro fun parlours. And it's a song cycle of Poulenc and Mahler and various other music that was so prominent in the 1930s. And it's a homage to the loss of innocence of young children at a time of Great Depression. The 1930s, there was fascism. World War II was about to commence. You know, there was a lot of Cold War conflict, if you like. And Luna Park opened in 1935, just for fun, at the height of the Great Depression, with these two gates that wanted to sort of show solidarity to the US and Western capitalism. They resembled the Chrysler Building. And Matthew Barclay and Brett Waymark from Sydney Philharmonia Choirs have put together this wonderful immersive song cycle experience with Peter Coleman Wright, Cheryl Barker, 15-piece chamber orchestra that are going to sit on this vintage topsy-turvy. And you as audience members will walk around a little bit like when you go and see the Berlin Radio Choir, you know, and they do their immersive experiences. I got inspired by that. I said, let's make something in Sydney that really tells our identity. But there's many, there's immersive experiences with food, with projection. We have an immersive experience where a boat's going to sail through Sydney Harbour, drop anchor and do a contemporary music performance, and you'll all be on the foreshore watching. I think if you can feel like you're participating as a festival goer, then you really have this great unique experience. And people can participate in temperament, you know, they can participate in Ensemble Apex, Bark in the Dark, if you like. They can watch Paul and Silveri paint this mural. They could probably purchase a mural after the show, you know, get up and throw a few paints down and get in amongst it. But I just think, like, to be active as opposed to passive in a festival can be really an exciting thing to do. But it's lifting the identity, whether it's the identity behind a composer and who that impacted or inspired, or the identity of a city and how you sort of ringmasteress all of that together. I think that's certainly something that gets me up in the morning.
I'm so excited just hearing you speak like that. And you, Ben. Yeah.
We're excited to have you play.
I can't wait for all this to start now. I mean, not that I couldn't before, but I sure am now.
Two more sleeps. So it's festival evening.
Two more sleeps, right?
Yes.
5th to the 28th of January. And they always say save the best till last. So the Bach program is in the final week. Yeah.
Well, he was the beginning and the end, right?
He was.
Well, look, thank you so much to the both of you for coming on my podcast, Talking Bach. It's been amazing to talk to you all. And if you listeners out there aren't inspired, then I don't know what is going to get you inspired after this. So jump on the Sydney Festival website.
sydneyfestival.org.au.
Yeah. And give them a call. There'll be numbers there. Email for any information you like. Jump on Bach Academy's website. All of the links are there. If you jump on Benjamin's websites and socials, all the information is there. You know, it's pretty hard to miss.
It is. Thanks, man. Thanks for having us on.
But I can't thank you both enough for coming on. And we will see you there, ladies and gentlemen.
Bye.
See you soon.
Bye.